Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. At 16, Reginald Dwayne Betts went to prison for carjacking, tried as an adult, and locked up for 8 years. In prison, he found poetry, or poetry found him. Now he's out, a third-year student at Yale Law School, and writing powerfully about the world that saw so much of his generation land behind bars, about the experience of being there. His new collection is called Bastards of the Reagan Era, and he means, first of all, the fatherless children of that time. This hour on Point, poet Reginald Dwayne Betts. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is Reginald Dwayne Betts telling the story of your community, telling your story? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New Haven, Connecticut, is Reginald Dwayne Betts, author, poet, law student now at Yale. His first collection of poems, Shahid Reads His Own Palm, won the Beatrice Hawley Award. His memoir, A Question of Freedom, won the 2010 NAACP Image Award. His new collection of poems is The Bastards of the Reagan Era. It's been hailed as haunting, harrowing, devastatingly beautiful. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Reginald Dwayne Betts. Dwayne Betts, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Hats on. Thanks for having me.
Who are the bastards of the Reagan era?
Yeah, I don't. Well, I was about to say I don't know, but I actually do know.
Okay.
But I think it's a complicated mix of young men, and the book is primarily about young women. I mean, about young men, not to ignore young women, but I think it's sort of just about me and a bunch of people like me. And it's about the generation, though. So it's sort of bastards. I think of it in two contexts. Is one, just thinking about being like not growing up with a father, but two, also thinking about it in the context of like that group of young people who were essentially abandoned by like an entire community and in some ways like an entire country.
It's so interesting. When I first saw the title, I assumed that you were going after some, you know, officials in the Reagan administration. No, you're a poet. You're turning it around and looking at people in the streets. You were in the streets. And I think if I've got this right, a little inspiration might have come from a Kendrick Lamar album back in 2011, a Section 80, was that it? Concept album? I got a track here, Chapter 6. Let me just play this and tell us if this was in your ears as well, a little bit from a skit on the Kendrick Lamar album, narrator sitting kind of around a campfire.
There's an even more important topic I'd like to discuss. The dysfunctional bastards of the Ronald Reagan era. Young men that learned to do everything spiteful. This is your generation. Live fast and die young. Who's willing to explain this story?
With the boys and girls and we're high.
Dwayne Betts, is that a challenge you took up?
I think so. I think I had already been sort of thinking about those issues, and I already been writing about those issues, and the challenge became sort of me wanting to own this sort of this task of not just talking at the world and at my community, but trying to talk to my community and trying to think deeply about, you know, the stuff that that was bothering me. And I think that troubles that album, too.
Would you read a little bit? We want to hear your story, but I know you've been telling that for a long time now. You've been out of prison for at least a decade. One of the pieces in Bastards of the Reagan Era, and I mean, this is a collection that's just getting unbelievable praise. Michiko Kakutani, my old schoolmate at Yale, called Fierce, Lyrical, Unsparing, Haunting, Harrowing. Talks about you with your ability to use the musical power of words to convey what it is to grow up black and marginalized and the crushing, humiliating experience of prison. Poems taking place during the crack epidemic of the 1980s. You've got one called Prophets of Rage. It's not long. I wonder if you'd read it for us, Dwayne.
Yeah, definitely. So Prophets of Rage is the last section of the poem, the title poem, Bastards of the Reagan Era. Mm-hmm. Prophets of Rage. This dance we do, it borders on insane. We all have names we let bravado mask. Think Cassius Clay becoming Ali. Blame this debt we pay the human gal on shame. That's why Raymond became Ray Ray, why Charles became Big Slim, then Chucky, Porkchop Black. Not Charles, nah, never Charles, always in search of room, escape, a way to run and claim the blocks that buried us, launched us on this, a flight from freedom. But I digress. We were all running down demons with our chest out, fists squeezed to hammers, and I was like them, unwilling to admit one thing. On some days, I just needed my father.
Reginald Dwayne Betts reading from the title poem Bastards of the Reagan Era, Prophets of Rage. We all have names. We let bravado mask, and you go right to Cassius Clay, becoming Ali Muhammad Ali. That's a street thing. It's also a prison thing. And why, you're saying? Why?
Well, I think it's trying to grapple with who we actually are. And I think, you know, the Cassius Clay thing was probably more complicated because it was religious in nature. But but what I was trying to push at was this idea that, like, I know when I went to prison, I'm named after my father. So my dad's name is Reginald Dwayne Betts. And I went to prison, and one of the first things that happened was I saw all of these dudes changing their names. And part of it was religious, but part of it was trying to turn away from the thing that got him in prison and sort of turned away from at least part of that identity and claim a new identity. So I remember everybody, well, I picked it myself. It was Shahid. And part of it was because Shahid meant the witness. And I thought that, you know, I could embrace that and become something that was slightly different from who I was that ended up locked up in prison. And then I came home and while I was in prison, one of the things I realized was that in a lot of ways, like, I had relived, you know, my father's narrative without really knowing it. And I looked at the men that I was meeting as in many ways representations of my father. And so, you know, I realized that some of the running away was running away from myself. And that's probably why by the time I got home, you know, people were calling me Dwayne again.
Shahid in prison, not out. 16, you were in there. You were an honors student and ended up doing a carjacking. And as I read it here, the next day you were in front of a judge and everything was changing in a big hurry. What were you doing as an honors student hijacking a car?
Yeah, man, I don't know. I don't know. I think you do wild things when you're in situations where wild things are possible. And the crazy thing is, you know, everybody say the story about it only happened one time, and then most people don't believe them. But it literally did only happen one time. And to this day, I've held a gun exactly one time and probably for a total of 11 minutes. But it profoundly changed my life. And I don't have a real reason besides the fact that that it was a possibility. And I thought that it was possible for me to do this, and that irrevocably changed my life.
What was going on in the culture that put you and many others on that road? I mean, you end this poem saying, on some days I just needed my father. You're talking about a lot of fatherless children, fatherless sons, in effect. I mean, more that would come because so many were sent to prison in this decade. Is it to do with fathers? Is it to do with what is it?
So I actually got to tell this story because when I got sentenced, I had already pled guilty. So the major issue was, like, why should the court grant me mercy? And a bunch of my family members got up on the stand and essentially said the same thing. You know, he's smart, good kid, didn't have a father. And the judge asked me if I wanted to speak. And my first response was, I didn't do this crime because I didn't have a father. And I felt like it was really important for me to say that because I've got a great mom, still have a great mom. And she instilled all of the values in me that allows me to do the things that I'm doing today. But I think in that poem, what I'm pointing to is, it's not all the time, but sometimes you just need a father. And that idea of just needing a father isn't sort of just needing the individual that is your father, but needing that community to add that other half of your growth and your development. So yeah, I think that's part of it. It's not the whole part. And how did I end up there and how do we end up there? It's some communities, and I think it's hard for people to understand because a lot of people that I run around with now and a lot of people that I go to school with have never been in situations where crime was regular. But when I came up, crime was regular. And it didn't mean that all of us were out there, you know, robbing people, stealing guns, driving in stolen cars. But it meant that some of us were. And it meant that, you know, I knew enough people who were doing it that I just wasn't strong-willed enough or wise enough to make better choices. But I could imagine, and like right now, I have two sons, and I think about their life, and I think about their childhood, and I recognize that they grew up in a world in which those things just aren't in the realm of possibility for them. And so a lot of times we want to focus the conversation on, like, me as an individual instead mm-hmm. of thinking about, you know, how do we decrease some of these negative options? Because it is hard sometimes to get away from it, especially when you're dealing with all the other stressors that come with, you know, living in impoverished communities and going to poor schools or just living in a violent place.
You're talking so much bigger than just your personal experience, and I want to take a lot of that on board as we go further into this hour. As well as talking about people, as I read you here, sort of make their livings off of mythologizing all this, used to make black men rich, peddling the prophecy of the doomed Negro and broken Negroes, Timberlands and Glocks, and don't shoot my baby because that football contract from a toothless crackhead was the mascot, one of the poems in Bastards of the Reagan Era. It's far behind you now. You're out with three volumes of work here. We're going to look at how you got into that. Who slid the first book under your door? Where did you begin your reading in prison?
Yeah, so I actually got really lucky. I came in and I thought if I get my GED, then I'll get a shorter sentence. And so I went to get my GED. And anyway, I met a teacher, and the teacher had me reading a lot. And then a few months later, maybe a year later, I was in prison in solitary confinement, and somebody actually slipped the Black Poets under my cell door, and that's how I became a poet.
We're going to look at that and much more with Reginald Dwayne Betts. His new collection of poetry, getting rave reviews, is Bastards of the Reagan Era. Behind us here from Kendrick Lamar's 2011 album Section 80, the song Ronald Reagan Era, His Evils. A little inspiration for Dwayne Betts. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. That life is full of hydraulics up and down. Get a six-fold, better know how to drop it. I'm driving on E with no license or registration. Heart racing, racing past Johnny because he's racist. 1987, the children of Ronald Reagan rake the leaves off your front porch with a machine blowtorch.
I'm really out here.
Stress, hoping that he's the stress. He copping some blow, hoping. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with a poet of America's prisons and beyond, Reginald Dwayne Betts, imprisoned at 16 for carjacking, out at 24, self-taught, now a celebrated poet of America's incarcerated and its underclass, a very fine poet. His new collection is Bastards of the Reagan Era. He's now a third-year law student at Yale. He's well out of prison at this point and has put his life together in a big way. You can join us today. What do you think? Does America's underclass, its black underclass, need a poet, lots of poets, to tell the heart, the truth of its story? Did you see the 1980s make bastards, fatherless children, of the children in your community? Listening to Dwayne Betts, are you thinking of all the potential, the heart and mind and soul, locked up behind bars in this country right now? Dwayne, would you read another poem for us, maybe for the city that nearly broke me? Tell us a little about it and read for us, would you?
Yeah, so this one is for the city that nearly broke me. I think it's really in response to all of the stuff that's been happening over the past year. For the city that nearly broke me. Nothing here can be considered prayer. Not clasped hands, not heads bowed in abeyance, not the screams that ratchet against the white walls of this school. The students lean in, swallowed by the noise they invent, staring as two bodies prance around each other like the shadow of God's hand sparring with the world. And someone will die, though not here, not this day, in this hall where trauma clashes and breaks against silence. The inevitable, the world reduced to fists and heads weaving. Blood is the voice of an angel leaving the body. So what are the two boys in this hallway doing? Evicting angels that keep us ruined in these bodies, forever longing for a flight they refuse to give. Those winged bodies thrown from heaven. I watch the boys fight. Most will call the light-skinned kid pretty and imagine this life is good. But pretty won't save anyone here where currency is blood, when pretty has failed everyone, even angels, out to leave us to this world.
For the city that nearly broke me, nothing here can be considered prayer. Help us with that line, Dwayne. What do you mean?
Yeah, I think actually that poem came. I was teaching in D.C. I used to teach poetry. Mm-hmm. in Southeast Washington, D.C., and I was teaching at one of the local schools there. And I just remember walking through the hallways, and then it was a fight going on in the hallways. And it just made me think that that sometimes the days seem so dark that it feels like nobody is praying. And if you think about praying as a way to struggle, we're trying to make something better. It was just that poem came out of a moment where I think I just felt like this was a part of the world that we just weren't paying attention to in the way that we could. And I actually felt really helpless, both like unable to get to where the actual fight was occurring and sort of unable to imagine what I would do if I got there.
Did you see those kids and think about your own prison experience? About, do they still look vulnerable? Like that still could be their path?
I try like really hard not to predict a dark path. I mean, if I see them and I see myself in them, I actually imagine them at Yale Law School, which is, I think, good for me.
Yeah.
And I think hopeful for them.
Yes.
But what I do see is sort of this, I do still see this sense of like not being guided by, and this is beyond family. I mean, I see this sense of not being guided by people around you who you think should be pushing people in certain directions. That's what I see when I look at them. And also I see a fear, man. It's just kind of, I would see a sadness and like, how do you actually push from one space to the next? But then that was just one moment. There was other moments where I think people were different and surprising, and they inspired me and pushed me too.
We're all thinking about kids in classrooms this week, where the girl in high school in South Carolina flipped out of her chair, and the policeman in trouble over that fired now, and the word that came out later that she was recently orphaned and in a foster home, and you suddenly open a door into all the trouble that a young person can be facing all at one time.
But more than that, I mean, I taught poetry, and so one of the things about teaching poetry is that students will say things to you in poems that they actually don't have space to say anywhere else in school. And even the fact that this kid had just lost a parent or just mm-hmm. was recently orphaned, like mm-hmm. nobody would have known that nope. before this incident where they started digging into her past, mm-hmm. probably looking to find something negative about her.
Reginald Dwayne Betts, with a lot of years in prison and a lot of beautiful poetry now from his hand, his mind. Roberto in Madison, Wisconsin. Thank you for calling, Roberto. Lots of callers for you, Dwayne. You're on the air with Reginald Dwayne Betts, Roberto.
Oh, hello, Tom and Reginald. How are you guys today?
Okay.
I'm good.
Dwayne is breaking up. I know he's asking you what advice you have for young black men in prison today. How should they handle it? Is the summary I've got from my producer who grabbed him. Sorry, we lost your line, Roberto. What do you say?
Yeah, Dwayne? I mean, I think it's two things. I think one, prison is just like an unbelievably difficult place to forget survival. I think a lot of people survive, and we survive in miserable ways. And I think the focus shouldn't just be on survival, but how do you imagine thriving? And my real advice is just to do things and plan your life out in sections at a time and work really hard to accomplish those things. So I remember, you know, teaching myself Spanish, and I spent 6 months studying like 3 or 4 hours a day just to sort of learn Spanish for no other reason than I told myself I should do it. And I remember taking a paralegal course for no other reason, and it was just something that I could do, and my mom was willing to put up the money for me to do it. And now I'm in law school, and I didn't take the paralegal course with any intention of being in law school. I took it because it gave me something to do during the days. And then after I took it, it gave me a way to get a job that paid 40 cents an hour. And then after I got that job, it gave me some insight into how to write a habeas corpus petition. But all of those things sort of sprung from me just trying to find a way to do something. And I was able to kind of do those things in part because I had family support, but in part because I imagine a life, you know, bigger than a penitentiary.
But your poetry makes clear, I mean, the challenge of keeping that positive attitude so high. I'm reading here from Louder Than a Bomb, and you write, these cuffs are like a goddamn noose around my neck. I peddled crack to pregnant women, and this cell is my reminder of the wages. Rockefeller and Reagan, the NAACP, all wanted us away from corners, dead or jail, but gone. I could tell you I changed, but history will haunt us all. My past, almost a way to prep for this descent to Red Onion, a prison carved inside a mountain where black men go to die slow. That is a tough vista.
Yeah, I think, no, it is, but life is tough. Yeah, I mean, I thought, actually, I mean, that is tough. I just read that again. I got a friend who's still in Red Onion. And so
it's a prison in Virginia, I think, right? Onion?
Yeah, it's a prison in Virginia. Mm-hmm. And I have friends who are still locked up all over Virginia, but I particularly have a friend who's still in Red Onion. And what I think about that is I wasn't trying to run away from how difficult it was here. But I think the other reality is that you could get by if you push and if you have family support. And so now I'm fortunate enough to sort of reach back and try to do something to help mm-hmm. other people that's inside. And that's the biggest thing is that, you know, how do you survive prison? How do you thrive in prison? You don't do it alone. Because mm-hmm. when I was facing everything that was in Red Onion and everything that was in prison, I never had to do it alone. I always had my mom. I always had a couple of friends. And to be frank, you know, I always had the men who were around me. At least a few of them mm-hmm. who actually provided me with support because I was a child and I actually, you know, grew up mm-hmm. and became a man in prison. And so as dark as prison is, it also are these spaces in which people push each other. And, you know, I had a whole community of Latinos who, you know, helped me learn Spanish. It wasn't just me. So I mm-hmm. think it's two narratives and maybe the book pushes on one narrative, but it's an echo behind that. And I think I try to get at that at the prelude because the reality is mm-hmm. everything in the book happened, but I happened as well.
You, your sons, you write about naming them and the hope and aspiration that has gone into that. I want to hear more of your poetry, your thoughts on the old heads in prison and more. Call from long way from New Haven, Connecticut, Spokane, Washington. April, you're on the air with Reginald Dwayne Betts.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling because I'm a public defender of 20 years, mm-hmm. and I originally started out working with adults. And a couple of years ago, transferred over to working with juveniles. And it is heart-wrenching to see what we are doing to the young people in our country. It is...
What do you mean, April? What do you mean?
Well, they are... they see what's going on out there. They know... primarily, these are... underprivileged children, the privileged children don't get caught up in the judicial system. They're not the ones that are getting arrested, even though they might be engaged in the same types of behaviors. It's the lower socioeconomic class that gets caught up. And they see what's going on with the other kids that have the cars and have the school supplies and they can see the disparity in their situations, and it's appalling that we use the court systems for these children when what we should be doing is supporting them, helping them find jobs, letting them know that we care about them, that they're important. I get it. I see it. I understand now what is going on. And until society figures it out, decides that they're going to wrap their arms around these kids, it's not going to change.
April, I so appreciate your call from Spokane. I mean, Reginald Dwayne Betts, you write something different. In the poem we just read, Louder Than a Bomb, read a little bit of, the people just want a lot of these kids out of their sight. This cell is my reminder, you write. Rockefeller and Reagan, the NAACP all wanted us away, dead or jail, but gone. That's a very different response.
None of them were public defenders either, mm-hmm, I think. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, I mean, look, my judge, when I was sentenced, mind you, I was 16 years old and I committed a carjacking. And I think one of the points that the previous caller was making is that everybody who ended up in prison didn't commit the most violent offenses. And so we sort of try to rationalize this systematic removal of young people into the system as a response to very violent crimes. And that's just not the reality. You know, I went to prison in 96 when you had John DeLulio and other scholars saying that we had a wave of super predators. And I was actually called a menace to society by a prosecutor. And I was 16 years old. Mm-hmm. I had a high school diploma. Mm-hmm. And the judge told me, I'm under no illusion that sending you to prison will help.
But he also said you can get something out of it if you want to, and you did.
Except that's true, except it's kind of dangerous because mm-hmm. I was 125 pounds and like 5'5", yeah. and I went to prison with grown men. Yeah. And so, yeah, I did get something out of it. But, you know, that is because I was extremely, extremely, extremely fortunate. In fact, I was lucky. I find four-leaf clovers all the time, mm-hmm. and I think the only reason I find them now is to remind me of how three or four different decisions could have ruined me. And I have friends who were ruined by three or four different decisions. Mm-hmm. The book acknowledges that a lot of, like me and a lot of my friends, were involved in dirt and involved in things that you know, weren't all good. But I think the book also tries to push upon this point that the response to that doesn't always have to be what it is. And the response to that shouldn't be generalized based on the worst and should, you know, reflect mm-hmm. the range of experiences that people have.
Reginald Dwayne Betts writes in a poem called Elegy with a City in it, you write, Chocolate City awash in red, 500 bodies lost to morgues, red, the gift of Glocks, red, sometimes a dark and awful omen, the best couldn't read, death reinvented when red was the curse of men born black, and lost in a drama, Reagan read as war. Denise in Columbia, South Carolina, you're on the air with Reginald Dwayne Betts.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm
okay. Thank you for having me. I just wanted to congratulate Mr. Betts on all of his success and congratulations on the success of the book. But I guess I consider myself a Reagan-era baby as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw, grew up seeing a lot of young black men, my peers, my friends, you know, caught up in similar situations as yours, maybe just one small offense and, you know, getting sent away for, you know, long periods of mm-hmm. time for most of the rest of their lives. And it seemed really unfair that these harsh sentences are, I guess, you know, using a bomb to kill a fly. You know, yeah, maybe correction needs to be made. But I think there's no question some of the responses from the system weren't fair. But I wanted to ask him, with all the praise that you now give to your mom, why do you feel like you or maybe some of, you know, our other young black male peers had such trouble resisting negative influences, whereas a lot, like myself, a lot of black females, you know, I also was, you know, surrounded by influences like drugs and things and yet resisted. So I just wanted to hear his opinion about sure. why all of the positivity from the females in his life was not enough to curb your indecisions.
Oh, thank you, Denise. Dwayne?
Yeah, I wrote in my other book, in my memoir, that people want a reason, and sometimes the reason is just that, you know, you're willing to take more risk than others, and sometimes the reason is that you step out on the ice a little bit further, even though you know the ice might very well kill you. And I think that, you know, the reality is we think about the family and we think about the influence of the family as if that's central to the life of a young person. Sometimes it can be central, but a lot of times you have a lot of other influences pulling against that person. I mean, I go to Yale Law School, and it's not as if I just became intelligent. One of the things is I was a reader before I went to prison. I went to prison with enough credits to graduate from high school. And I can't name a single person that I've ever come across in school who was willing to invest in me and imagine that this was what my future might look like. I can name like my second grade teacher and a history teacher that I had in ninth grade. Two people who I thought, like, actually thought that I was intelligent and had a future. Maybe two other teachers. So I think, you know, what you're asking is can the love of a mother and can the support of a family win out against another sort of all of these other voices that's telling you what you can't do. And in a lot of cases, they just can't win out. And again, we're talking about me. And when we talk about me, we talk about somebody who had demonstrated the ability to, you know, go to college and succeed and be a successful student. And I still couldn't get the support. And I actually asked for the support sometimes from school teachers and got rejected because I talked too much, because I was pretty loud. But you make different decisions. You don't have to reject people just because they look like they aren't ready for your support at that moment. I was a kid.
Interesting, though, Denise, also thinking about gender here and how some young black women, some may resist some of the temptations that you and others have not. Not all. Plenty of women of color in prison as well, and we know that. We'll come back to that. Reginald Dwayne Betts is with us. His new collection of poetry, Bastards of the Reagan Era. It's really something. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with poet of America's prisons and beyond. Reginald Dwayne Betts is with us. He was imprisoned at 16 for carjacking, out at 24. Now he's finishing up Yale Law School. He's out with his second volume of poetry. It is called Bastards of the Reagan Era, and it is pretty great. You can take a read at our website, and we'll hear more from him right here. Lots of people responding to you here online. Ka says, really highlights the thin line between rap and poetry. Powerful. Nancy says, I hear the voices of those who didn't have the chance to tell their story. I hear echoes of lost potential, she says on Twitter. And here another listener says, black people have always had their poets voicing the suffering that has often come with blackness. James Baldwin, Maya Angelou, Bob Marley, Langston Hughes, Alice Walker, Tupac Shakur. Congratulations, Mr. Betts, for joining this class of greats. Pretty good company. Calvin in Sumter, South Carolina. You're on with Reginald Dwayne Betts. He goes by Dwayne. Thanks for calling, Calvin.
Hello, Tom. How you doing? And Dwayne. I'm going to have to sue you because you didn't took my heart and my feelings and exposed it to the world. What
thanks,
you're
man.
Saying, man, let me tell you, I just now picked this up today and I heard some of your poems. And I'm hearing everything I've been preaching. I'm an activist here. This is what we go through. This is what society pushes many of us black males, black people, period, into. A life of making bad decisions. Why? Because they've taken the good decisions away. Many of our communities lack jobs when they used to have jobs. But when we moved into those communities, they took those jobs out of our community. And when I go into the prisons and talking to a lot of these fellows, I'm like, you know, yeah, everybody can tell you to stop doing what you're doing, but they have not provided an answer for you. Our elders, our ancestors, our olders, I don't call them elders, I call them olders. They have not laid down a foundation in which they can provide jobs for their own sons. See, everyone else that's here, they can provide jobs for their own sons. And that's the key to success in this society. But blacks have been excluded out of doing this. They don't even give us the loans to start businesses to provide jobs for our own babies.
Calvin, can I come in right here with a little bit of Dwayne's poetry, and then I want to give it to you, Dwayne. But this just speaks to this, and I wanted to bring this theme up. You write, old heads here. You're talking about in prison. Old heads. These are elders that you admire, say these chains and cells and walls state numbers, years and years and years upon years and years ain't nothing but Jim Crow. They say it's slavery. The young'uns damn near think it's normal, though. They have known cells like rivers and brown and black men returning to prison as if it's the heaven God ejected them from. When you hear Calvin in South Carolina, then you're quoting your old head saying, this is Jim Crow. And you make many allusions to this mass incarceration being a kind of new slavery.
Yeah, you know, I think the main thing is when you think about it, I went to law school. This is funny. I shouldn't even say this, but I went to law school because I was having a difficult time like finding a job to support my family, and I was living in Boston, and it was organizations that I interviewed with literally that when they found out that I had a record would take the job away from me. And so that's why it's great. And this happened to me in Boston. It happened to me in D.C. I had full tuition scholarships pulled from me because I revealed the fact that I had a felony. And so one of the things that I think about in terms of how to make a way, especially after you came out of prison, is to support initiatives like Ban and Box and to think seriously about the impediments that we put in people's place when they are trying to do something different or trying to build something and establish something for themselves and their families.
Speak to
the and mind you, these were progressive organizations too. You know, it is one, and that's why I said the NAACP because I was trying to sort of broaden the conversation and not act as if it's just this X group of evil people who are like putting the boot down on people's necks and throats. It's actually all of us.
I mean, it's ironic because now it's part of your calling card in a way, part of your cred. But speak to this systemic issue. It comes up again and again in your poetry. These references to slavery, to men, usually in your poetry, in prison as if they're on slave ships. What are you saying?
Yeah, the truth is, man, when I went to prison and, you watch when you go in a court for the first time, you go in an arraignment and you chained and linked together for like 30 or 40 other black dudes. And it does feel like a kind of enslavement. And I get the argument. The argument is that as an analogy, and I've made this argument myself, you know, as an analogy and as a metaphor that goes too far, because Africans who were enslaved never committed crimes. I get that. But then it's also this question of how do we respond to certain behaviors and communities, and imprisonment does not always have to be the response. And when you find that you have disproportionate numbers in the way that we do all across the country, you have to think that something else is going on. And so one of the reasons why, and some of the poems push back against that, but one of the reasons why I say slavery while also acknowledging the culpability is to put the onus on all of us to say, how do we respond to these things that exist in our community? And how do we respond in a way that doesn't actually destroy our own communities? Because we've responded to drugs and we've responded to violence, I think, in a way that did more damage than otherwise.
Reginald Dwayne Betts writes, I have braved, for want of wild beasts, steel cages, carved my name on bunks and rafters. I fought grown men near double my age for a rep, and now this guard, he yanks against the chain so hard, I buck, then buckle, a man against a leash. Morgan in Matthews, Virginia. Calvin, thank you for your call. Morgan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Dwayne. I just want to make a comment right along the lines of what you're talking about now. The traumatic environment inside correctional facilities that we maintain and let stand does what a friend of ours in California calls, makes them a monster factory. And, you know, the place is full of Dwayne Betts. This is who the people really are. They're all those people. And yet, you know, the sentimentality that we hear about this, that doesn't do anything. That just damages and maintains the status quo. We can change that culture of incarceration, but we've got to get real about it. We've got to get serious about it, and we got to see what the damage that it's doing. And then we got to listen to people like Dwayne. And I wonder, you know, Dwayne, your ideas about what you saw in there and your ideas for changing that culture of incarceration.
Morgan, thank you. Dwayne?
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing about it is that it's a complete lack of programming in most institutions. And so I think one thing is to create institutions that actually have legitimate programs and legitimate training that allows you to have some kind of skill and some kind of marketable skill when you go home. I think the other real thing is, you know, correctional officers aren't even paid that well, and the onus isn't on safety. Like, if you think about it, if the recidivism rate is 70% coming out of one institution, it's not as if anybody at the institution is being judged based on those failures. The only people who get judged based on those failures are the people who leave prison, when in fact, some of that is based on the, you know, criminogenic effects that go on inside the facility. Some of it is based on the trauma. Some of it is based on the fact that you just spent 6 years of your life in prison and didn't learn a single skill and didn't have the opportunity to learn a single skill. You know, everything I learned in prison, I learned because my family members were able to provide me with some money so that I could take advantage of things that were offered from people outside of the institution. Institution didn't provide any of those things. And so you think about it, it's easy to spend 5 years in prison, 6 years in prison, and come home with nothing to show for it, and come home to be a larger burden on your family members, on a society as a whole.
Here's a moment from Bastards of the Reagan Era. A waste, we half dozen, half shuffling, scuffed and nicked on another schooner, bound for some Sing Sing, for some Angola, Folsom, Attica. Jim in Hilton Head, South Carolina. Jim, you're on the air.
Thank you for having me. I was a police officer for 25 years, from the 70s until the mid-90s. And myself and my colleagues used to get so frustrated with the system because we would have young offenders, and we would bring them into our station, and there was a disposition that was entitled counseled and released. And the reality was there were no resources given to counsel these young offenders. And what would happen, we would see repeatedly the same offenders coming in over and over and over. And two things would happen. Either they would reach 18 years of age and go to jail, or they would commit a serious crime and find themselves incarcerated. And that used to frustrate us so much. And instead of dedicating more resources to the problem, what I saw, particularly during the Reagan and subsequent years, is more incarceration. And we're so happy to build prisons to hide the problem. And now, ironically, we're starting to say, wait, do we need all these prisons?
Jim, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. I want to get one more poem here, if I may, and I hope it speaks in a broad way to what you're saying, to the bodies of men in those prisons. Reginald Dwayne Betts, could you read What We Know of Horses? And it's a horse as in H, as in heroin, but also the experience of prisoner. Could you read that for us?
Yeah, I'm going to read the first section and the last section, What We Know of Horses. And when my brother says Swan Road is the world, he ignores boarded vacants, broken windows, displaces shattered glass. He tells me, believe the world is a tenement house, a pocket full of stones, a world of ghosts and what's left of ash and smoke after each inhale. I visit now that a prison cell holds this world. Dead men circle every block we know. Thread this world with quotes from Psalms. The sorrows of death embrace me. Some trust in chariots and some in horses. They embrace metaphor, disbelieve gravity, breathe in a haunted world. And what of my brother? Running the streets, he was a horse, graceful, destined to be broken. Why compare everything fast and beautiful to horses?
And I love the ending of this poem where you write, I want to stop and embrace my brother, to hold him close and pause, to inhale the scent of prison, to tell him what I smell, what I inhale is still the body of a man. Montanez in Nashville, Tennessee. Montanez, you're on with Dwayne Betts.
Gentlemen, how are you?
Okay.
The conversation itself is a cumbersome one. When you start to speak of Reagan, you have to take into consideration all of his presidency, inclusive of the Iran-Contra and his failings as far as the drugs and guns that were involved in U.S. policy. But more so, what I'm finding as my experience being a young black man in that Reagan era is that the sense of hopelessness that I felt was centered around the lack of finance. Everything in this country is built on economics. The prison system itself is on the stock exchange, which shows you the power of economics, and we're actually trading lives for money. So everything that we're doing as far as young black men, I feel, is in response to the lack of finance that we have, the inability to be able to buy, to have nice cars, nice clothes, these things. And it is fortunate and an unfortunate testimony that Mr. Betts has given of his experience that is all too familiar to black men all across this country.
I appreciate your call, Montanez. Are you a system thinker in that way, Reginald Dwayne Betts? Are you thinking about economic policy? Are you thinking about cultural impulse? Where does your poet's mind go? Where does your lawyer's mind go being crafted now?
Yeah, honestly, I think, I do agree with that. And I think I'm a system thinker in some ways. But I also think that, my intent in going to law school is really thinking about the individual level and thinking about how to repair individual harm. So, some of that goes directly to what he was saying in terms of finance and the inability, not just to buy nice things, but the inability to sustain yourself. So the first thing I plan on doing when I get out of law school is do employment discrimination work, because, again, I recognize a lot of people are qualified for jobs that they can't get. But I'm definitely a system thinker. But I think as a lawyer, and at least for me as a lawyer, what I want to do is like have one person that I'm representing or a group of people that I'm representing and work really hard to get them the outcomes that they need. Because what you find often in the system is you just feel desperately lonely. And I want to push back against some of that.
Are you, it's a cliched phrase, but are you scarred for life by those 8 years in prison? What's the long-term personal impact of 8 years in prison?
Yeah, man, I don't know. I think, I think I spent 8.5 years in prison, and I remember talking to a psychiatrist once because they made me go talk to a psychiatrist. They made everybody do a screening at this one institution. This is 6.5 years in, and I laughed at him because he asked me, had I thought about suicide? I thought, I've been in prison for 6.5 years. I've been in solitary confinement for over 1.5 years. My first 10 days at the Fairfax County Jail was spent in solitary confinement before I pled guilty, before I'd been sentenced. I wasn't allowed to take a shower for 8 days. I was forced to sleep on a concrete slab with no blanket and no pillow and no mattress for 8 days. And you are asking me if I've considered suicide. And I think that the bigger question really is what do you do with the trauma that you inherit, the trauma that begins to embody who you are? And am I scarred? I think definitely I'm scarred, but I think I'm probably scarred in ways that only the people who love me and who see me at my most vulnerable know, and they probably don't even know it, because I actually don't have conversations about like depression and pain. And the only reason that I've even said it now is because you've asked me, and I think it's because I want to highlight the fact that that what all of this stuff produces is a kind of vulnerability that you're forced to mask. You know, the thing that you can't be in prison is vulnerable. But the thing that you always are in prison, at least as a 16-year-old, is vulnerable. So it's this wild catch 22 where, you know, you're stuck between a rock and a hard place. And so I don't know. Of course, I think I'm scarred. I think I have trauma. And I think that I may just manage better than some.
There are personal questions here and big questions as well. I want to leave us with one last bit from the book. Dostoevsky, What Did He Say? Reginald Duane Betts writes, "You judge a nation by its prisons. Had he said you judge us with our crimes, this van runs off the rail and back into the Atlantic from whence we came. But see, he didn't say that. And so what does all this say about America?" From Reginald Duane Betts, Bastards of the Reagan Era. Reginald Duane Betts, thank you very much. We wish you great luck with a long and rich career. Please keep bringing us your insights, and please come join us again. Thank you very much for being here today.
Hi, Tom, man. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. It was good.
Reginald Duane Betts is now a final year law school student at Yale Law School. His collection of poetry, Bastards of the Reagan Era, excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.